All right, y'all go ahead and mark your calendars. Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th is the Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia. Y'all have heard us talking about it for years, and it really is. It's the highlight of our summer. We absolutely love that show. We've met so many of you guys at that show over the years, and it is just it's like the perfect environment to go and meet like-minded hunters, hang out, have a good time, and get ready for deer season. So obviously, as the name implies, it is the place to go and try all of the mobile hunting gear coming out right now. We always recommend to people, if you're thinking about getting a new stand, a new sticks, a new saddle, go try it before you buy it. The Mobile Hunters Expo let you try almost all the brands in the mobile hunting space in one spot in one day. There's really nothing like it. So not only do you have all that gear available to you, they also have a great speaker lineup. This year they've got Bobby Worthington, Dylan Harper, Mariah Boggess, Derek Norwood, and BHA all giving presentations where you can go learn from those guys and ask them questions. So if you've heard us talk about the Mobile Hunters Expo for a couple years now and haven't made it out yet, don't let this be another year that you miss it. Y'all come on out. We'll have a great time. We're excited to meet you guys there. We can't wait for it. We'll see y'all there. Again, mark y'all's calendars. It's at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. See y'all there. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck, and I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.
The cool thing about those community springs is just the way that they will draw all the trails together. Because, I mean, you can go up in a lot of these travel corridors up high and you can see that, you know, there's a lot of trails in the area, but they're spread out. I mean, they could be, you know, 15 different trails spread out within 150 yards, but it's really too wide to really take full advantage of the whole travel corridor. But if you put that spring in the middle of that exact same terrain setup, all those trails come together into one spot. Mm. And honestly, as soon as I figured that out, I haven't really focused on anything else.
All right, Dylan Harper. What's up, dude? Welcome to the podcast.
Just hanging out, man.
I met you at the Mobile Hunters Expo last August. We're recording this way ahead of time when it comes out. We're at the Unicoi Turkey Show right now in northern Georgia. Might hear some turkey calls in the background, but we're talking deer and bear today. But I met you at the Mobile Hunters Expo last year. You'd been recommended to us. I'd followed you on social media and everything, and I immediately recognized you. You came up to the booth, and you're like, let me show you something. You whip out your backpack and you pull out like a whole oak limb that's got acorns all over it. And you're like, we're loaded this year, like heavy mash year. I was like, anybody that shows up to the Mobile Hunters Expo with a backpack full of oak limbs and acorns and everything, I'm like, I'm going to get along with that guy. So that was cool. That's the first time I ever met you, dude. You're out scouting, I guess, checking mash trees.
I'd actually got up early that morning and I was going to the expo, but I had something to check because, I mean, it was getting pretty close to the opener. So just a last minute to-do list, and I went up in there and was pretty impressed with what I saw. But yeah, I just brought a couple in just to show a couple people that I met at the expo. But
yeah, dude, that's cool. Jacob, how are you doing?
Doing well. That's my kind of show and tell. Yeah. No, so Dylan, I'm excited because, first off, one thing I've been following along with you this year, I want to say you really started posting more about it last year too, or I'm sorry, this year. Like 2025, you posted a lot about it. I think 2024 you posted about it, is how you like to hunt topography up here in the mountains, North Georgia, but also how water sources high, up high play a factor for you, for both deer and bear, and also wrapping that in with food sources. And a lot of times when at least we've interviewed guys in the mountains before, we've never really got into specifically water sources and how that can play such a factor where, you know, deer and just game animals in general don't have to drop a bunch of elevation to get down to a creek system and how they can find it up high, which is something we're going to talk about today, which I'm really excited about. And you just showed us an example of how you can find kind of like a guaranteed one of those spots in the mountains, which I think people are going to enjoy. But I want to just start off, what is your background hunting the mountains? Is it something you've done your entire life, or did you get into it later on in life?
No, so I grew up in a hunting club, actually. So, you know, from a young age, I was hunting in a two-man ladder stand with my dad. It was probably about when I was 18 years old. It came down to, you know, it's time for me to pay my own dues. But around that time when I was a teenager, you know, I thought sitting in a ladder stand all the time was just freaking boring. So I'd get down and start walking around the club, and I'd run into other members, and they weren't happy about it. So they pretty much had a come to Jesus meeting. They said, dude, you can't do that. So anyway, the hunting club environment really didn't appeal to me anymore. And me and my dad, we were talking about it one day, and he's like, well, you know where you're going to go? Like, not really. I'm going to figure something out. And he said, I got something for you. So he drove me to this little dirt road at the beginning of the mountains and pulled up in this little cul-de-sac. And I think that was more of like a nudge to like, you know, you're going to find out what it's really like and you're going to find out why people want to pay for a club. And well, I went scouting in the mountains and the very first day I was in there is when I discovered bears. And that really just, you know, opened up a whole new world for me. But yeah, it's really just the aspect of having a lot of land to work with and just having the freedom to move and not really worried about property lines and messing with other people. So,
oh yeah. That freedom, especially when you start at a hunting club, and that freedom of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres you can go run around on, is one of those things I think that catches some people's attention. Because if you are always, you know, stuck to individual spots you pin out on a hunting club, or just a few thousand acres that that club has, it's only so much you can walk. I mean, it's a lot of, I mean, for a lot of people, it's a lot of acreage, but if you like to walk, you like to scout, you like to cover some ground, you really feel boxed in. So I'm sure these big pieces of public land make you feel like you can stretch your legs, which I know you can.
Oh, yeah.
And find some fairly untouched places as well, which is a sense of adventure there, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah. I've had cellular cameras running in a couple spots for 3 or 4 years now, and I've yet to see another person walk through it. So you can invest a lot of time in these places and not really worry about, you know, other people boogering it up or changing their patterns. The only thing is, like, you're kind of at the mercy of the mass crop. So you kind of, you got to spread yourself out a little bit. Just kind of learn a wide range of areas at high elevation, low elevation, you know, different counties, different WMAs. And really, you want to just learn as much as you can about as many places as you can, you know, especially if you've got Onyx. You can just start dropping pins on all these spots that you find. And then at the end of the summer, whenever the mass crop is pretty much going to be what it's going to be, well, you can just go back through this bank of information you've collected over the years and just say, all right, 10 out of these 50 spots are what I need to focus on for the rest of the year. But that's pretty much the gist of it. A lot of people say that there's no point in scouting during the summer for bears. People say there's no point in scouting at all until August when the mass crop is coming in because, you know, obviously they're more of a food-driven animal, but it just goes back to having as many places as you can find. And, you know, if you want to be efficient, it requires a lot more mileage. Spot bouncing.
At the beginning, I want to ask you this. I don't know if you track it or have a ballpark, but in a year, like say this year, how many miles do you think you hiked from scouting and hunting?
Not as many as I used to. It could be 300, 400, 500 miles a year. And most of that mileage is scouting. During the hunting season, I would say maybe 80 miles for bear. And then by the time deer season comes around, I've already got presets. You know, when I find these spots, I will pretty much throw a loop of paracord in a tree because I climb DRT. All I bring is a saddle and a rope. But yeah, I just go into my spot, pull the rope in the tree, and there's not really a whole lot of walking involved for that, other than, you know, the logistics of just getting in there. Got a lot of campsites kind of preset. That way, you know, a lot of the places I go into are pretty remote just because that's the style of hunting I like. A lot of people say, you ain't got to go that far to go get something, which that's true, but it's just the experience that I'm after. So
yeah, the sense of adventure and the experience. So you'll spike camp, I guess. What's the longest you ever stayed back in a spot camping?
Really about 3 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Man, that's awesome. That's cool. So your dad got you into hunting the mountains. Was your dad a big mountain hunter?
No, my dad wasn't. He was born with some kind of hip degeneration. My uncles are very big mountain hunters. Like I said, the majority of my childhood was, you know, in a hunting club. But there were a couple times here and there when my uncles would drag me out and take me in the mountains. And that's kind of, I guess I kind of had a head start on how that works. So I wasn't totally, you know, just starting from scratch when I turned 18 and started hunting the public, but yeah.
Okay. Where did you learn a lot of the things that you know about topography right now? Like, because you've got a pretty impressive knowledge of not only topography, but also, like, we're going to talk about LIDAR and springs and everything like that. Is that something you just studied on your own, or did you learn that from your uncles?
No. Only piece of advice I was ever given was just to find white oaks, and that's literally it. I have met a couple people along the way, and it seems like, you know, when you put two heads together, you know, you pretty much learn from other people. I'm actually good friends with a guy from southeastern Ohio, and he's really the one that turned me on to very specific terrain setups as far as, you know, he had a background in trapping. So when he wanted to learn how to hunt bears, he set out a big spread of trail cameras in these very specific areas, and that was what turned me on to those kind of spots. But as far as the water table features, that started from a YouTube channel. It's called the Geo Models. Geologist Philip Prince, he went up to investigate the triggers of the landslides from Hurricane Helene, and he was just, you know, it was completely unrelated to hunting, but he just started pointing out different things in the video of what he was seeing, and I was like, what? I rewind the video, and he starts saying, you know, this is a macro pour right here. And then when this busted from, you know, 30 inches of rain coming down and the ground kind of gave out, it left this scour. And then he'd pull up like a LIDAR image of, you know, what was left of it. And I'm like, I've seen hundreds of those. So then that's when I started, you know, using the LIDAR to find those scours. And then I'd go out and hike and see what they look like. And that's pretty much where I'm at with that. Only started doing that last year, by the way.
Okay.
Very interesting. So you're talking, when you say scour, you're talking about like a landslide.
Yeah. So it's basically where, you know, so much rain came down on the ground that the soil just turned into soup and it just gave out and went down the mountain. And what happened was it exposed a macro pore, which is basically like a, think of a blood vessel under the ground. So whenever the rain comes down, it goes into the soil, and when it, you know, goes down in elevation, it all gets funneled into these little vessels. Well, when that scour gave out, that vessel was exposed to the ground surface. So now you've got a spring.
Very interesting. And you say, when you say I've seen hundreds of those, when people remember back in Helene, it was awful, but all those landslides, barren, down the side of the mountain, wide open, like the trees are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like the, literally the earth just gave way, big landslide. You're not necessarily talking about seeing those like that around here. Are you talking about seeing older ones that happened 100 years ago?
They could be thousands of years old. So, I mean, if you really look at the bottom, like if you've got a main valley between two major ridges, you'll see kind of at the head of the valley where I guess the face of the mountain starts to level out, you've got kind of a bottom, you'll see the collection of just sediment, you'll see piles of boulders and rocks. That is from the remnants of landslides.
Oh, wow. That's cool. That's interesting. And you're picking that up on LIDAR?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I want to say, what is the importance of finding these scours and, like, these spring heads? Like, what's the importance for you of finding stuff like that?
Well, there's really two different types of springs that I think they have two different purposes. Well, there's more than that, but there's only two that matter in my eyes. The scours are more of an isolated water source. You'll find them in really odd spots, you know, just on the face of a mountain or just really steep places that don't make any sense, because most of the time your good springs are actually produced on flat ground. But with it being isolated like that in an odd spot, it's not near any significant trail or travel route. It's just isolated in its own spot. The other one is, you know, I've totally made these names up for them because I've never heard anybody else talk about them, but I call it a community spring. And that's basically the type of spring that is dead center of a major travel junction. And they're usually associated with a bench or some kind of flat level ground. Often it'll be produced by, you know, compounding terrain features or a topo hub, you know, just where a bunch of stuff comes together. I don't think it really matters as much for deer throughout most of the year, but the cool thing about those community springs is just the way that they will draw all the trails together. I mean, you can go up in a lot of these travel corridors up high and you can see that, you know, there's a lot of trails in the area, but they're spread out. I mean, they could be, you know, 15 different trails spread out within 150 yards, but it's really too wide to really take full advantage of the whole travel corridor. But if you put that spring in the middle of that exact same terrain setup, all those trails come together into one spot. Mm. And honestly, as soon as I figured that out, I haven't really focused on anything else.
Is that where you killed your bucks this past year?
Mm-hmm.
Spots like that?
I killed everything in a spot like that.
Mm. Bears, deer?
Bears, deer, pigs. As far as the significance of it, I've noticed, because I did like a little miniature trail cam study this year, just to see what happens. I've only got one picture of a deer actually drinking water out of a spring from March to December. But during the rut, that's when all the bucks started traveling through that travel corridor. So that's really the main significance of it for the deer. But for bear and hogs, they are much more dependent on water. Because deer, you know, you've heard people talk about how they get most of their moisture content from the browse that they eat.
Mm-hmm.
Pigs and bears are not like that. So water is much more significant to them.
Interesting. Are you finding around these springs, maybe not right on the spring, but just in the general area, let's say within, I don't even know, half a mile, are you finding higher concentrations of deer in areas like that? Or is the feature a little bit too common to really
concentrate? I think with those isolated scours, a lot of times you get like jewel weed and, you know, a lot of green vegetation growing up through it that's a lot softer. Deer use that to browse. But as far as anything else, no, not really.
Okay. Interesting. I'm just thinking of an area that I hunt in Alabama that I found something pretty much exactly like what you're talking about. There's a big rock scour down below a big saddle on a bench. And I looked at it for years on the map. Finally walked into it this year. And you get to that rock scour, it's just boulders on the ground. Me and my stepdad walked up to it, which I was telling you, he's a geologist, so he's real fun to go out there with, like, because he just can kind of explain what you're seeing. And we were standing there on top of those boulders, and there's, like, this weird, like, deep, I don't even know, like, hum almost sound. We're like, what is that? And we eventually realized it was water rushing underneath those boulders.
Really?
You can't see a drop of water. Like, can't see it at all. But when you're standing there, you can hear it. And it was like 11 a.m. in the summertime, hot outside, and there was a cool breeze coming down those rocks where that thermal was still pulling down. We go up to the top of the scour, and it just ends abruptly. Like, the rocks just literally end on that bench. And then you keep going up a little bit more when you're getting near the saddle, big laurel thicket up there. And then in that laurel thicket, there was like little spring seeps all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like water literally just bubbling out of the ground. And there was all kinds of deer sign in there. Like the deer were clearly spending a lot of time, and there was plants in there that you don't really see often in that particular area. Like you get in there and it's just different.
Yeah.
And there was a concentration of deer sign, and I left a camera in there and it fell off the dang tree. So I don't know what's in there. Lost a year of data.
How does the camera fall off a tree?
As that would be user error, my friend. That one's on me. But anyways, that's why I was asking if that's something that you've seen in the past, because it's just a weird feature. And there's not really a lot of water up on the side of that ridge other than that.
What I'm thinking of when you say that is how you said the water bubbles up out of the ground, but when you're below it, it was underground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly the same in Georgia, but it really creates an isolated water source up high like that, because it'll come out of the ground and then, you know, probably 15 feet or so to go back under. So I've heard people say, well, hell, all you got to do is just follow a blue line on your topo map all the way to the top and there's the spring. Well, the springs that we're talking about right now, there is no blue line leading to it.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, there's really no other way to find it than using LIDAR or just putting boots on the ground. So with them being isolated like that, you know.
Well, that was the, I'll pitch it to you. There, that was the interesting thing about that spot, because the only thing that drew it to me is I could see the rocks and on the LIDAR and everything. I'm like, I got to go look at this because it just looks weird. And so we actually checked it on our way up to a different spot. We kind of swung through there. And going up the ridge from the bottom, there's no water in that creek at all. You're walking a dry creek bed. And we had a lot of floods this past spring. So the creek bed's all blown out. There's no leaves in it. It's pretty easy walking. And you're just walking. And it's just your typical little dry creek bed up in the ridge. And then you hit that boulder line, and then you can hear the water. And then you go a little bit higher, and boom, you got water. Way, like, far away from any other creek or anything like that.
One thing we talk about with almost every guest on this show is map scouting. My favorite map scouting tool is LIDAR. If you're unfamiliar, LIDAR is basically like a 3D scan of the Earth's surface. I like to say it kind of takes away all the surprises. LIDAR is now available on OnX Hunt on their topography map. If you go to your app right now, click on the topography map, you can flip on that LIDAR feature and boom, it's going to come on and you're going to see what I'm talking about. The LIDAR is going to allow you to see things that are normally hidden from view. This might be ditches, bends in creeks, rocks, old roadbeds. I personally love old roadbeds because deer like to walk them. They're great places to find scrapes. They're great camera locations. And you know, before, an old roadbed or an old logging road might be something that you kind of happen upon while you're out scouting or hunting. Well, now with the LIDAR, before I go into an area, I can turn on that LIDAR and I can see exactly where those roadbeds are. Even old logging roads from the 1930s, you can still see them on there. So that allows me to go straight to those spots and check them out. It's just an incredibly helpful tool, and it's available now on OnX Hunt. And hey, if you want to get 20% off your OnX Elite membership, you can use the promo code Southern. Like I said, it's going to save you 20%. Go check out that LIDAR feature. You'll be glad you did. Know where you stand with OnX Hunt.
If you're traveling to hunt this fall, you need to check out Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone to rent an RV or a camper without owning one. I'm going to be honest with you guys, I wish I knew about this sooner. There's been a couple hunts over these last few years where, you know, depending on where you're going to hunt, there might not be good hotel options, there might not be good rental house options. So, I mean, this is perfect for the traveling hunter. They've got thousands of RVs and campers nationwide, available right in your neighborhood. You got multiple ways that you can travel. You can drive it yourself, you can tow it, or you can have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. Outdoorsy also has built-in peace of mind. They've got comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance included. So not only is this a good option to give you a good place to stay even when you're going somewhere pretty remote to go hunting, but it's also often more affordable than hotels, especially if you got a good group of guys going with you. So how it works is you just search and choose an RV that fits your trip and your group size, you book it with confidence, and then you hit the road, whether you're driving, towing, or getting it delivered. And right now, listeners of the Southern Outdoorsman podcast can have all service fees removed from their booking in 2026 with show code OUTDOORSMAN at outdoorsy.com. That's OUTDOORSY.com. And use the code OUTDOORSMAN at checkout to remove all service fees.
So, I'm sorry, what were you about to ask?
Well, kind of was the Andrew's question. Instead of like talking about like concentration of more deer, do you find more buck sign around those kind of spots, specifically like pre-rut getting into the rut?
For the community springs, yes.
Okay.
Just simply because it's a travel corridor. I don't think the water really has as much to do with it.
No, okay. But it's more so the trails kind of, for whatever reason, come all down to that same spot.
Now, I will say, like my buddy, he's up in Ohio. He's run cameras. I mean, he's got a little private farm that he manages, and he has water, what do you call it, like little stock tanks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He'll set those up in specific locations, and he has deer drinking water all the time. He's got a creek that runs through his property, but he said that the deer really prefer to drink out of stagnant water for some reason.
I've heard that too.
And also, when you got a creek, like they have to go down below the bank to get to the water. And he thinks that maybe they don't feel quite as secure ducking their head down like that. But when you have the water just kind of on a flat surface and it's stagnant, like nothing's obstructing their ears, they can still see. So maybe it's a security thing.
Interesting. I've seen where you, we're going to get more into the nitty gritty of all this. And I really want to talk a lot about summer scouting, but I've got all these little one-off questions because I've been watching you on social media for so long. One thing I saw you do, this was very interesting, is you took a daggum shovel up into the mountains and you dug out some spring heads. I guess you were really doing that for bears. So what were you doing there? Why'd you do that?
Curiosity. Really, just in case there was a drought, I kind of thought maybe if I dammed it up a little bit and dug it out, maybe it would be a little more resistant to the drought, which turns out it was. But that's really all it was. But what happened was when you start creating these pools of water, the bears are really attracted to it to wallow.
Interesting. So there's like a bear hot spot.
Pretty much.
Okay.
From March until the end of September, it was nonstop bears.
Dang. So explain what you were doing there. Like you went and dug out a spring head, but like what were you actually doing? Like how did you find the spot? Like what was your thought process there?
So as far as how I found the spot was just using slope angle shading and LIDAR, maybe cross-referencing with like a mass-producing oak layer on Onyx. It's not really reliable, so you got to go look at it. Once I saw the amount of trails that were there, just dug it out, dammed it up, put a camera on it just to monitor it out of curiosity and also to start hanging presets. Basically just taking a throw ball and throwing the paracord up in there and just having it ready for the rut. And that's really it. There's not much more to it.
Okay. So that it really didn't do much for deer, though.
No, not really. One thing that kind of helps, you know, in August, you have to do a lot of footwork as far as finding the mast and the elevation or whatever. I took a gamble this year thinking, okay, if I got these trail cameras set up in, you know, various different elevations, maybe I don't have to work as hard to go find the mast because the cameras will tell me where it is. Because obviously, if you've got bears, deer, hog, whatever, just kind of gravitating towards certain areas, well, that's where the mast is. And it pretty much worked out.
Okay. I want to talk about your summer scouting, I guess, routine. Like what, let's say 2026, going into this summer, what is your process? When do you start? What are you looking for, thinking ahead to deer season?
Basically, in the wintertime is when I will seek out new areas just because, you know, post-season, the leaves are down. You can still see a lot of the scrapes and rubs and stuff. In a lot of the areas that I'm in, I don't really see a lot of that sign anyway. But yeah, just looking for new ground in the winter. In the summertime, or I should say the springtime before the summer, I like to get the cameras pretty much set by the end of March. And that's before like the bears start emerging. A really big problem with trail cameras is bears are very attracted to them. And it's funny, you guys interviewed a guy, oh God, I can't remember his name. He trains the canines, and he was talking about how scent molecules and stuff
work. Tom Brownlee.
Yeah. So he was talking about how when they're, you know, trailing the bad guy, the dog's not actually smelling the person, but the disturbance in the ground that person left. And we just collectively, as a group of people, my circle, just noticed that if you set up a trail camera and it gets whacked by a bear, it's usually within the first 3 days of hanging it. And I think that episode of the guy with the dogs pretty much explained why that happens. So it's, you know, I want to get the trail cameras up and in the tree and running before the bears come out. That way they don't follow my trail and find them. pretty much.
Oh, so you don't think it's, I've heard some guys talk about like the, they smell the batteries maybe.
I'm sure they do.
But for, in your understanding or experience, if they're going to hit a camera, it's going to be pretty quickly after you put it out there.
Yeah, their human footprints look exactly like a bear stomp trail. So, I mean, just individual footprints in the ground. I don't know if they think you're another bear or they're just following you out of curiosity, but I mean, if you walk in front of your trail camera during hunting season, within 48 hours, you're going to have a bear on your trail, just following your footsteps. So, and you can hang them in the summer. It's a little trickier just because, you know, everything's going to be a lot more active, but I've figured out that if you can create like a scent distraction off the side. So you want to, you know, hang your camera without scuffing up the tree and just, you know, marking up the spot that you're in. But if you walk away from your camera and you just start kicking leaves out and breaking little saplings or whatever, whenever the bear is following your trail, there's going to be so much more scent coming from the other direction that it usually diverts their attention. And if you can get your camera to survive for 3 or 4 days, you're most likely it's going to survive for the rest of the year.
That's very interesting.
I know a lot of our mountain listeners are going to greatly appreciate that tip.
Yeah, because I mean even if, again, guy putting a trail camera out for deer, like I see how effective that could be, especially if they're in higher bear density areas like Georgia, North Carolina, East Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia. That's interesting. What'd you call it? Scent diversion?
Scent distraction.
So going back to summer scouting, so you like in wintertime when the leaves are off, you like to look at new areas. You want to get your cameras pretty much set before the bears come back out. What about going into May, June, July? What are you trying to do?
Just exploring, staying in shape. There's really not much more to it other than, you know, just monitoring the mass crop for the rest of the year and hanging the presets. Because, I mean, like I said, most of the rut hunting locations that I'm picking out, like I pretty much got all the spots that I want by June. And then around August is when I will decide, you know, these are the ones you need to focus on simply due to the mass crop. So, I mean, honestly, as far as the summer scouting, I think the best thing that you could use as far as determining which location might produce more deer or not is the amount of bears that travel through. Deer will pretty much replicate the same rut pattern that the bears do. So if you've got, say, 4 new spots that you've never hunted, you don't have any historical data with, but you've got a camera rigged up in all 4 of these, and one of those cameras in particular just has a butt ton of, you know, big mature boar bears coming through it, more than likely, that's going to be where you have the most buck traffic. And I say more than likely only because you're still at the mercy of the mass crop. So just over time, if you can just collect as many spots as you can and then just, you know, just have a bank of information and places you can go, I mean, it's just so much easier by the time fall comes around to pick out a spot.
Are you typically running cameras on most of these seeps, or do you put them on anything else, like if you're trying to get inventory of what?
I mean, you can put them on, you know, just basic travel corridors like a habitat edge or, you know, a bench or like a saddle, anything like that, a topo hub. But I like to hunt all 3 species, so the water source is really what I try to focus on.
Okay. And just to clarify, you're talking about like basically the bear rut.
Yes.
Which is June.
Bear's rut in June. So if you've got your camera rigged in March and it survives the next 30 days, by the time the bears are in full rut and they're cruising, you know, looking for sows, that's basically when I get my deer hunting information. So they will tell me, you know, which areas I need to focus on in the fall.
Based on terrain.
Yeah.
Just because if that terrain funnels the bears, it's going to funnel the deer and hogs and everything just the same.
Now, do you see bears, though, using, say, ridge systems differently, as in where they like to walk compared to deer or hogs for that matter? As in, I've heard some guys talk about they like walking the spina ridges and all that stuff where a deer might be a little more side slope. I don't know if you've
seen like that. Bears will do that in the summertime, more so than a deer would in the fall. But in the places where you find these springs, it's usually not on the top of the ridge anyway. But I have seen deer use the top of a ridge, but as far as like there's different types of ridge setups as well. If you've got like a sharp knife edge ridge, I usually don't see anything using the tops, but you know, maybe coyotes or bobcats, stuff like that. But what really draws a lot of things is when you have like a softer, more rounded ridge top or even a creek bottom. You know, if you've got a really steep ravine, stuff doesn't like that, but if it's like a really broad, wide, flat creek bottom, that's, you know, the animals really prefer those as well.
Hmm. When it comes to the trails that you keep mentioning, you mentioned a couple different times, especially around these seeps, where you might find a bunch of trails in an area, but they all seem to converge in one spot. You put a big emphasis on trails, specifically for deer?
Yes. Yeah. So I think what happens is, you know, throughout most of the summer, your bear and your hogs are basically the animals that establish a lot of these trails. But if you'll notice, right around the end of October, 1st of November, it's like flipping a switch. As soon as the leaves fall off of the trees, the bears go nocturnal. So, you know, most of the year, they're daylight movers. But as soon as they go nocturnal and they start slowing down, I'm sorry, I'm bouncing all over the place. Through the summer, you don't really see a lot of deer. But as soon as those bears go nocturnal, you get like this explosion of deer. It's like they swap places, more or less. But the deer are basically just following the trails that are established by the other animals earlier in the year.
Okay. And trails in the mountains are really interesting to me because whenever I find a trail, whenever I'm hunting mountains, wherever I'm at, whether it's North Carolina or wherever, I'm like, that trail's probably been there for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because this terrain hasn't changed, you know, and that deer's 10 times great-grandfather's probably walking that same trail, right?
Yeah.
And so do you find that trails are something that are very reliable year to year? Like if you find just a really nice trail that pretty much every year it's hot, or do they change?
It really depends on the terrain setup again. Like if you've got a really sharp knife edge ridge, you know, nothing really uses that sharp top. So when they use the trail on the side hill, you know, the ground's so steep that it pretty much gets cut into the side of the mountain. I mean, you could walk on it without, you know, flexing your ankle. They're pretty flat. But as far as, you know, like the average trail that you'll see on more rounded ridges, it really just depends on, I mean, you can have a herd of hogs for a month come through and they will pretty much establish a new trail. But if they don't keep using it, it will disappear over time. This year, you know, a lot of the major trails that I saw, they weren't there. I'm not really sure what the reason was. We had kind of a weird white oak crop this year. It seemed like, you know, they got hit for a little bit in the higher elevations. Right around the last week of August, first week of September. But for the rest of the year, it seemed like a lot of the animals were dropping down in elevation. And you could sit there and watch the trails that were established over the summer. And, you know, especially after the leaves fell, it covered everything up. And, you know, if nothing's sitting there punching holes in it, you know, it's not going to get reestablished until something does.
That's a good tip. That's just a good woodsmanship tip right there. Because when we talked to Joey Youngblood, we drove through North Georgia, interviewed him on our way to go hunt Western North Carolina. We were going to do a mountain bow hunt up there. And one thing that Joey told us, he's like, hey, when you find these trails, if the leaves aren't just chopped up, like you literally came in there and chopped them up, he's like, they're not using it right now. It might be a really good looking trail, but the leaves weren't even really falling yet. But he's like, you can still tell when those leaves are just chopped up, that's where the deer are at. And then like 2 days later, we were up there hunting, and that's pretty much exactly what we saw. And that's just a little thing you can pay attention to where you don't really need cameras or anything like that, but just like a little woodsmanship tip of how you can tell whether or not a trail is being used. Is that something, do you do something similar to that? Like just picking up on small things?
For deer, absolutely. This year, I got a pretty big curveball simply because of that elevation shift. A lot of the hottest places that I was pretty much banking on were completely dead. And I ended up dropping down in elevation. And I mean, it was night and day difference. You could see maybe one rub tree up high, and you know, the trail was just so faint that, I mean, you just look at it, you're like, there's no way anything's using this anymore. But, you know, you go down in the bottom and you can see that once again, like after the fresh leaves have fallen, they've still just got it cut down to the dirt and there's fresh rubs and everything. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's pretty obvious where they are.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So if somebody was wanting to go out, let's say they don't have a big Rolodex of spots from years of hunting mountains or anything like that, what would be one of the first things? Like, let's just say we picked you up and just dropped you in a totally new area. What would be the first thing that you'd be looking for, again, let's say in the summer months?
Terrain-based travel corridors. And basically, you guys interviewed Chuck Young, and this guy's probably my favorite person to listen to out of everybody, just because I really like the guy. But he talks about compounding terrain features, and I've kind of got a different interpretation of what he does. He talks about kind of like this continuous sequence of, you know, maybe a saddle will run into a bench and then there'll be a draw at the other side, you know, just bam, bam, bam. What I'm basically looking for is terrain features that are stacked on top of each other. Most of the time, I'm going to be looking for a bench or something associated with it, you know, like a flat spot, maybe where a couple ridges come together and a topo hub. What that does, that's basically what creates the spring head that draws all the trails together. I mean, just get on a LiDAR map and use some slope angle shading. I mean, they stick out like a sore thumb if you really know what you're looking for. That'd really be the first thing that I would look for. Once you find it on the map, just put boots on the ground and see if there's food nearby. And if there is, I mean, there's not much more to it, honestly.
So let's say you're using slope angle shading, like on Onyx. What are you looking for on that slope angle shading in that situation?
Basically, you want to have a high peak nearby. And then, you know, it can be shaded purple, it could be shaded red, even yellow. But if there's like a really defined green spot and then it turns back to a red or yellow, whatever it is, that's it. But you want to have steep topography on both sides of the bench, like above it and below it.
Okay. And then so that's how you identify the bench. And then once you find the bench, you're looking for a saddle up above it?
Yeah, so with the community springs, when I say they're in a terrain-based travel corridor, I'm going back to like the compounding terrain features. A lot of the best ones that are even, I want to say drought resistant, but not drought proof. It's, you know, if you find a bench that's directly underneath a saddle, you know, a saddle's more or less a water table funnel. You know, all the water gets channeled into one spot, and then when you have the bench directly underneath it, I mean, you've got a mega spring coming out of it. But yeah, those, I guess that's the compounding terrain features that really produce the best water source and also produce the best travel corridor at the same time.
Mm. Okay. When you walk into a spot, like, let's say you go find four or five of them on the map. When you walk into them, what are you looking for on the ground that tells you, okay, this is it, this is the one? Because I'm assuming you probably go check a couple of those and they're just duds.
Well, there's not a lot of duds. But you'll see that, you know, as far as like historical sign, every now and then certain ones will be better than the other. Just because, you know, maybe the mass from the previous year didn't really pop in one spot. So you got to take that into consideration. But I mean, it's usually pretty obvious when you go into one and, you know, there's just not a lot of mass producing trees or there's not a lot of browse nearby. I mean, you'll have traveling animals, but if you don't have like residents and travelers at the same time, your opportunity rate's going to be a lot lower.
Mm-hmm. That is very interesting. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for the ones that have, I'm assuming, oaks.
Yeah, you want to have a mixture of oaks, whether it be white oaks, reds, I mean, even chestnut oaks. A lot of people don't really pay attention to those, but, you know, sometimes, you know, they do get hit depending on the year. But if you've just got a mixture of food, that's really best case scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, those chestnut oaks, by the way. We talk about them pretty often on the on this podcast. And
negatively.
Negatively. But usually every year I'll find one, usually very early, that is just getting absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
And I found one on my club this year in Central Alabama. It was like that. It was the first feed tree that was just like mutilated.
Yeah.
that the deer were really using. I ended up missing a buck right next to it.
Mutilated,
as our buddy Greg Mayhair says, mutilated. So you made the point about you're looking for a spot that's got residents but also travelers.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean by that?
I guess the guy that really said it best was Bobby Worthington. The way he talks about long-range funnels and short-range funnels is basically the same scenario. I guess just worded a little bit differently. But you've got certain animals, like maybe just say a doe group, or you've got a sow bear that just kind of, she's got an established home range and doesn't really roam very far. Your doe groups don't really roam very far. They're pretty much residents of the area. So they're usually going to be your repeat customers that you'll see over and over again. Your travelers are going to be just, you know, bears oftentimes, I mean, they'll roam for hundreds of miles across different state lines. Not all of them do that, but you have that. They have a potentially bigger home range. But, you know, bucks during the rut, I mean, they're covering a lot of ground as well. So I would say a cruising buck is going to be the one that's traveling, you know, covering, you know, a lot bigger distance. And then you've got your does that are the residents. So if you're catching them both at the same time, then your opportunity rate, the amount of times that you see an animal or at least have an opportunity of taking it, goes up.
Okay. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. The other thing I wanted to ask on the terrain features, so you go in there and you check them. You want to find pass sign, you want to find trails, and you want to find browse and mass-producing trees. Getting into later summer, it sounds like you recheck those areas to kind of monitor your mass crop. So what's your process of monitoring basically where the mass crop's going to be?
Well, there's what I do and what I should do, for one.
I can relate to that.
I need to get me a pair of binoculars and actually start glassing treetops. I haven't done it, but really I'm just walking around looking for storm damage, you know, picking up broken limbs, checking for acorns that way, or, you know, red oaks often, they'll just shed acorns all year long. Hickories do the same thing. I'm just walking around checking for nuts on the ground and just blowouts, really.
And you're trying to correlate that with a specific elevation?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really important because, you know, if all your acorns are up high, but you're in a spot that's down low, it's pretty useless. If you don't have the food there, especially with the game density being as low as it is here, I mean, you'll go a whole season and only see one or two animals easily. But if you're in that, you know, good travel corridor with a trail pinch and you got the food nearby, I mean, you can see dozens. And, you know, dozens of animals in a year, that's a lot.
So I don't know about around here, but in Alabama, these past two seasons, so 2024, 2025, we had two complete opposite years. 2024, we had an absolute bust. We had a very bad drought. A lot of the oaks aborted their mass crop, and there was like absolutely no acorns on the ground. It was tough. I struggled that year. This year was the complete opposite. We did not have a drought, and we had a bumper year, which I think those two, I need to ask a biologist about this, but I think those two go hand in hand. Like they'll usually be a bumper year after a couple bad years because those oaks are trying to make up for it, I guess. But different guys, depending on how you hunt, tackle it differently. I do better on heavy mast years. I just always have better luck on heavy mast years. I know guys who like a thin mast year where there's just not a lot of oaks dropping because I guess it concentrates the deer more. I haven't figured that out yet, but I'm curious these past two seasons how you approached those two situations, assuming that happened in Georgia too.
Not exactly. As far as having a isolated mast crop, I mean, I think that's everybody's dream here because it really, there's not a whole lot to it. Once you figure out that isolated food source, I mean, that's where all the animals are going to be. Most people hate it when you have a heavy mast crop. I mean, it is a little bit tougher. Your opportunity rate will be a little bit lower. But, I mean, if you've just got, you know, a good travel corridor with very important habitat features, you also have to have those. I mean, you're still going to see animals either way. But I don't think most people really look at it that way. So when you have a heavy mast year, you know, they struggle a little bit more with it.
Well, I think the heavy mast years kind of go down that rabbit hole for a second. Normally, and we saw this in 2025, a lot of states, specifically in the Southeast, their harvest number for deer were down tremendously. And a lot of biologists were talking about it's because of the very heavy mast year across the Southeast, because majority of hunters typically are hunting some kind of food source, especially on private land hunting, whether it's food plots, corn, bait, whatever. That's what a lot of people sit on. And if there's tons of mast still out there, they don't have to come and feed at those food sources very often. So your harvest records, your harvest numbers are going to be down.
Yeah, they don't really move as much.
Well, exactly. They don't have to, and they can be where they want to be instead of where they have to be because limited food.
Yeah.
But it goes back to if you're a train hunter hunting travel corridors, it almost doesn't matter that much because if a buck's still going to cruise through there and the deer are spread out, he's got to move. He's got to cover ground. Mm-hmm. So that's where it's kind of almost seems like kind of just tried and true with those really tight, or not tight, but those highly optimized travel corridors, especially in the mountains, that you're still going to have the highest odds of success no matter if it's a bust year or if it's a bumper crop year.
Yeah.
Am I on track, you think?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Except when you have a spring head in a travel corridor like that really is like the tightest travel corridor that you can find that I'm aware of, you know.
Yeah. You get me interested. I mean, I know we've talked a lot about these spring heads, but got me more and more interested in that because I've seen that while I've hunted the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas where I bear hunted. Not to kind of get off subject with bears, but where the bears were at were also where the deer were at because it was a very sparse mast here. There was one drainage system my brother had found. He was in school up there. He had found a section that they had specifically red oaks. There wasn't many white oaks up there, but there was a lot of red oaks that had produced and a lot of hickories. And it was just that drainage system. He trekked up different parts of this mountain system for probably a five-mile stretch, and all the locals were talking about how bad the mast was. Well, every bear and every deer was in that drainage. And I say drainage system, it's not like a little drainage. This thing's like a mile and a half wide and like 6 miles long. And that's where all the animals are stacked. And I had an awesome hunt in one day. I'd never killed a bear.
Had the hunt of your life.
Dude, he had nine cameras out in the spot, and every day he had bears on camera, but he had also had a bunch of deer on camera. I had a shooter bear come by at daylight that I thought was a lot smaller than what it ended up being. I let it get 13, 14 yards, stand there for a little bit facing me, and then finally when it turned to walk away, that's how I realized how long the bear was. Like, should have shot that one. He slipped off the bench. Then rattled in or grunted in two bucks, really nice shooter, just really nice 8-point, not huge, but really nice deer came in at like 8:30. And then I moved further down the bench that afternoon, probably 400 yards, with the bench bent around a little of a ridge point, and there was a bluff gap right there, and there was deer feed sign, there's bear feed sign, there's deer scat, there's rubs, there was scrapes, or a couple scrapes, there was bear droppings everywhere. I'm like, this is it. Like, I'm going to hopefully kill something and kill a bear at like 4 o'clock coming up that bluff gap. And it was awesome, dude. Awesome. And then he tried to do that same hunt again the next year. I couldn't go the next year. And he's like, dude, it sucks. He's like, because it was a better mast year, mast was spread out, and like the deer were spread out. And this is also in October, by the way.
Yeah.
They rut in November. But deer were spread out, bears were spread out. He couldn't even find a bear that next year. And it was just crazy from year to year that just the change between that one spot.
Yeah.
Like you would have thought this is the best honey hole of your entire life, but it wasn't really like a big, we weren't hunting during the rut, but it wasn't like a really big travel corridor. It's had a lot of good stuff going on in one system, and deer and bear were just stacked in there.
Yeah.
So.
One thing that Jacob said a minute ago that actually you said to me at the Mobile Hunters Expo, I remembered this, was on a heavy mast year where they have food everywhere, they can kind of just go to where they really want to be. They're not forced to go to any one specific area.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, another thing, when I say I do better on a heavy mast year, I mostly hunt pine farms in Alabama. Oh. So we don't have a ton of oaks. And the oaks that we do have are going to be down in your little drainages and creek bottoms and SMZs. So they're already isolated. And so when you have that bumper year, to me, it makes it easier in a situation like that because I kind of know right where they're going to be. Because if I know that there's oaks in a bottom, I know that they're dropping, basically.
Yeah.
I can go in there and I can find sign. On bad years, it's not like that. And you got to walk so much. And usually the oaks that are dropping are in like weird little spots that are kind of tough to hunt. But also, I'll find a, like last year, I found one white oak on my club that was dropping. And I mean, there was some sign under it, but it wasn't anything very impressive at all. And I'm like, I think that they just don't really need to eat these as much as people make it out. Like they've got so much browse in those pines that they can go eat instead. And it's like, I don't know, they're not gonna go way, way out of their way to go find that one oak tree that's real hot or anything. So I think that is different. And that's one reason I like talking to guys like you who hunt these real big woods, mountainous settings. Because if you ever look at something like this on a map, it's just a vast mountain range that's all gray on the map because it's all hardwoods. It all looks exactly the same on the map. But then when you get out there, you've got to narrow it down. So we've talked a lot about terrain. Are there any habitat features that just jump out at you where you're like, oh, I got to go look at that?
Yes and no. We don't really have a lot of timber management here. So most of what our premium habitat looks like is usually from, you know, just like the eastern bands of hurricanes that hit us. You know, you'll just have like a whole swath of trees that get knocked down. Just pretty much like what happened with Hurricane Helene last, or I guess that was 2 years ago now. Tornadoes, wildfires are pretty good. I don't really like those as much because, unfortunately, Onyx will pretty much highlight that and everybody and their brother can see them. But we do have a lot of what I call short-lived, like wild lightning fires. And you'll see there are certain spots that, I mean, they got burnt, but they weren't big enough and they didn't really last long enough to draw a lot of attention to it. So you won't find those on Onyx or, you know, burn records. So, I mean, if you just pay attention to that, sometimes you can just see like an old tree that fell over and the bottom of it, they'll just have that old char mark on it. And you start looking around and you're like, dang, I'm actually in a burn right now. That's a good one. Mostly for deer. Bear, I really think hardcover is more important. But you gotta, deer, you know, also the water's not important, but for bears, you gotta have the food, the cover, and the water. Deer is really more cover. Deer gotta have the cover, the food, and really the right terrain that can follow their movement.
What about mountain laurel when it comes to deer? How much, or rhododendron, anything like that?
I don't really like the rhododendron just because it seems to be too thick. I mean, you can't really get through it. Young mountain laurel usually grows in an area where, you know, there's a lot of new sun exposure, so you'll have, you know, browse coming up with it. But as far as, like, security cover, it's got to be pretty mature. I mean, I'm talking 10, 15 foot tall. So everything can kind of get through it, you know. They're not really fighting with it, but it's just dense enough to where they feel safe and secure, but not so dense that it really hinders their movement, if that makes sense.
Mm. No, that makes sense. I know Jacob had a lot of questions on the bear hunt, and you kind of started talking about it a minute ago when we got off. when it comes to bear hunting specifically, are you more of an early season kind of guy? Like you want to go out there as soon as it opens and you're trying to bow hunt them, or are you waiting for the gun season to come in?
It really doesn't matter. Bow season is just an extension of the rest of the season. I think a lot of archers really like the fact that those first few weeks of September, the acorns aren't really dropping yet, so the bears are much more likely to be climbing trees. And as an archer on foot, it is so much easier to stalk a bear while it's feeding in a tree than it is to stalk one on the ground. Hmm. So I think that's really the major advantage of archery hunting. But you'll notice, you know, around the time the gun season start kicking off, that's really like the last week of September, there's like an explosion of bear movement. If you look at cameras, you'll see that just for whatever reason, there's a huge spike in movement. And I think that's right before the mast really dumps. But a lot of your sows that get bred, they're going to get ready to den. And I think it might be like an inner signal for them to start, you know, just searching for denning locations. But, yeah, I mean, there's advantages to every part of the year. I mean, even late season, there's an advantage to that. But, yeah, just any time you can get out, don't really matter.
Well, with bear hunting, I mean, you've kind of touched on, like, the water sources, huge for them, and these seeps. But when it comes to being successful bear hunting, like I've got a friend who's hunted North Georgia quite a few times, early season bow hunting for a bear, and he's seen some small ones. He's been kind of choosy about trying to kill a better bear and just hasn't killed one. What do you think is, if someone's trying to target bear, where do you think people go wrong when it comes to trying to find a bear early season or just trying to find a bear during season?
Just finding a bear or like
find them, but then get to execute an opportunity. So where do you think people go wrong with that?
Bears are pretty low density, despite, you know, what a lot of people might think. It's going to require a lot of covering ground just to find the sign. But understanding that once you find some really hot sign, you're within 200 yards of the bear, like most likely. If you look at some of the, like, if you find a really hot area one year and then you just kind of reflect on it and you look back, you know, say you start studying the map, most of the time there's going to be those habitat features involved. So anyway, if you just found some really good hot sign and you're there, you know, standing in the middle of it and you got a variable wind, like more than likely you might have, you know, even bumped the bear out of there just because they don't really travel that far from where they're feeding.
Okay.
I got a bunch of questions about that, actually. So I've never killed a bear. I'd really like to at some point. I've been wanting to come to North Georgia to bear hunt for years, and I just haven't made it happen. Schedule hadn't aligned or whatever. But I'm a complete novice when it comes to bear hunting. Don't really know my, I mean, I know what bear sign is. I know how to deer hunt. But what would you tell someone like me who wants to go and try to kill a bear in the mountains?
Basically, it's to be as successful as possible, it's going to be a time investment, especially as a non-resident. You're going to want to put some boots on the ground ahead of time. I guess the most beneficial time to do it would be in August. That way you're putting boots on the ground to see the landscape and finding everything, but you're also looking at the mast crop at the same time, right before it dumps. But, I mean, as far as, you know, finding the spot, you can do a lot of that just by e-scouting. But as far as when you're actually there hunting, I guess the best way to hunt them would be in like this triangular pattern. Like you just walk until you find the feeding sign. You know, I guess I'd look for the food first. Once you find, you know, there's a bunch of broken branches, tracks, scats everywhere, you really don't have very long to assess the situation unless you have like a good consistent wind that's blowing the way that you came. More than likely, they're going to be bedded within 200 yards, and they're going to bed, say, if you're up on a ridgetop and you found the sign, more than likely they're going to be down off the side because they always want to bed on a slope. If you ever like check up against the base of the trees, you can find where they bed. They'll scratch the bark of the trees. I mean, it's pretty easy to identify where they're bedding. That's going to be the first thing I look for after I find the feed. I mean, the best way to find it, especially if you've got some steep ground nearby, or I mean, even if you're driving down the road, bears don't have really good traction on steep ground. So when they walk off the top of the flat onto the steep ground, they leave freaking skid marks. So as far as tracking a bear to its bed, it's really not that hard. So if you found the feed sign and then you found the bed, but you still haven't found the bear, but you know, it's obvious that he's there, look for the water source. That's the triangle: food, bed, water. And if you just make that full rotation, you've usually got it. Unless you wind bump it or he sees you, you know.
Oh,
it's up to you at that point.
Are you typically going to find water around where they're feeding, or could they be traveling good ways?
It really just depends on the year. If you got an isolated mass crop and, you know, it just happens to be in an area where there's no water, I mean, it just kind of is what it is. But a year like last year when you got food everywhere, it's very important. I mean, their whole life's pretty much revolving around just packing on as many calories as they can while expending the least. So if they've got food right next to the water, that's going to be a more desirable area for them. I mean, it's pretty easy to see, especially if you walk a ridge that's got a bench somewhere in the middle of it. You'll walk through white oaks the entire time and not see any sign. But as soon as you get over that bench with the water source, now you start seeing bear sign. And then you walk away from it, it kind of dries up again. That's all because of the water source.
Oh, that's interesting. Hey, speaking of that too, when we hunted North Carolina that time I was just telling you about, it was the first day that we walked up in there and we went up to this little shelf that we were looking at it, and we're like, yeah, that looks pretty good. There's probably some white oaks up there. I think we were using the oak layer on Onyx. We're like, yeah, there's some white oaks up there. It's a flat. Let's go check it out. And we were looking for deer, and we get up there, and we're like, oh, there's a pile of bear scat. It looked a couple days old. We go a little further, found a fresh pile of bear scat. And then I think we found some broken limbs or something. We got to the shelf, oaks were dropped, and we're like, yeah, this looks good. We're looking for the base of the tree, and we turn around, and here comes the bear walking right at us. It wasn't bear season yet.
Yeah.
But that was the first bear I'd ever seen in the woods. That was cool.
Which I found hilarious, because yeah. I've seen more. And yeah. That was funny because that bear came in and that thing probably didn't weigh 80 pounds, 85 pounds.
Yeah, I was fired up.
And he's like, dude, he's getting jacked. I'm like, bro, you can't shoot it. You can't shoot it. Don't try. Season's not in. But, dude, it, oh.
I mean, they're cool.
They're it's a cool animal. Meat's phenomenal on them.
Yeah, they're awesome. I have a question, too, about when you're talking about scouting. Let's say you go out scouting August, September, it's go time. You got a bow in your hand, you're walking. When I'm in the mountains, I have a bad habit, really when I'm anywhere, actually, I have a bad habit of I just walk and I don't go that slow. I'll try to be quiet depending on the situation, but like I'm trying to cover ground, especially when I'm in a big area. Like if you're hunting up in North Georgia, if you're hunting in Eastern Tennessee or North Carolina, whatever, it's a big landscape and it's hard terrain to cover. And I'm trying to cover ground. How do you balance trying to cover ground while also still being in hunt mode where you're not walking into the middle of that sign and you're like, oh, there's a bunch of sign right here, but you were loud getting in and you probably blew the bear out?
Well, as far as blowing a bear out, it's not like deer. I mean, they're a totally different animal. So if you bump a bear off of the area that it's in, it's there for a reason. It's a really comfortable spot for it. It's going to come back. Sometimes within 2 or 3 hours, I mean, he'll come right back to where it was. So I wouldn't really worry about that as much. But as far as covering ground, it's important to kind of have a general idea of where you're going. Just doing e-scouting the best you can. Of course, you know, you can't see everything going in blind like that. But really, if you're in an undesirable area, or if you're on a hiking trail, just book it. Because unless you're in a really particular hot spot where, I mean, everything's attracted for a reason, I mean, you're wasting your time everywhere else. One of the best things that I've ever figured out is to do it with a partner, especially in the mountains, but I mean, you can do this anywhere. Take two vehicles, park one of the vehicles, and then ride together a couple miles away. That way you can both walk in the same direction. You can double your mileage that way. And really, if you know where you're going, I mean, just book it as fast as you can until you get to where you need to be, and that's where you slow down, investigate it. If it's not really looking all that good, then just go to the next spot, hightail it. And it's really a matter of getting where you need to go as fast as you can and then stopping when you get there, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
It's you're hunting with your ears more so than your eyes at the same time, especially in archery season. If they're up in the trees, you're not going to be able to see them unless they're in like this little short, stumpy, you know, dwarf oak. Because, I mean, there's been several times where me and a buddy, we'd be standing at a base of a tree and they'd be acorns landing on our head and just bark, tree limbs falling everywhere. I mean, we'd know there's a bear up there. And we're both just kind of, for 15 minutes, just walking in circles around the tree looking up, and we can't see it. So, I mean, I've even had times that I've walked right up underneath a bear that was feeding in a tree. I didn't know it was up there. And then as soon as I passed it, I mean, that sucker'd slide down the trunk of a tree like a fireman pole and take off running, you know? So, but bears, it's funny. They can be so stealthy it would surprise you, but at the same time, they can be the loudest animal in the woods. And like in archery season, when they're up in a treetop and they're feeding and gorging, they are just making the most god-awful racket. As soon as they stop, then you can't hear them anymore. But basically, you want to just move slow enough to where, or quick enough to where you're covering ground. You know, it's just slip hunting, but you're not really looking as much as you are just like listening in every direction. And then you just basically follow the sound until you find it. And once you find it, you might still have to wait another hour before it gives you a shot opportunity.
Man, that's what intrigues me about it, because I love to squirrel hunt in the early season. And I mean, it kind of sounds like squirrel hunting. Like when I'm squirrel hunting, I'm slipping along ridges and I'm just listening. I'm listening for the limb shake. And then, or you might see a limb shake way out through the woods. And then you stock up on it. And you guys sit there and watch for a little while, figure out where the squirrel's at, let him give you a shot. You know, obviously bears are different, but that sounds very similar as far as that goes. Now, when you find one up in a tree like that, I mean, are you shooting them out of the tree with your bow?
Yep.
Sick. That's cool.
Squirrel hunting with a bow, man. But the thing is, big bears don't really climb trees. So if you're after an older age class animal and you see one in the tree, I mean, you might see one that's about 200 pounds. But if you're looking for like a trophy class animal, you're never going to find one in a tree like that. And
what are they doing different then?
I mean, they're just so freaking fat, man.
I know, but I'm saying, what are they doing feeding at that time of the year? If they're not getting up in a tree, are they just like getting to where some's knocking acorns out or hickory nuts out or something?
I'm really going to ruffle some feathers on this, but chestnut oaks, man, like Andrew was saying earlier, they're the first ones to drop normally. Okay. So the big bears, they can't climb, or they don't want to climb. Usually they'll be just picking up the chestnut oaks that are on the ground. If there's not any nuts available, they're still hitting soft mass. So you got like high bush blueberry in a lot of areas. I mean, they'll hold fruit into November, really. Yeah, they don't even get ripe till the end of August a lot of times. But so also there was a study done by the University of Tennessee that really showed how different bears interact, because they're not all the same. You've got young bears or small bears. You've got old dominant bears. And then you've also got sows with cubs. And you have to understand the relationship and how they all interact, and also the pecking order. Your sows with cubs are very vulnerable because the boars are going to be territorial. They're going to go after her cubs and kill them. So usually she's going to be in the most undesirable spot that she can find. That way there's much less chance of her cubs getting murked, you know? So if you're seeing a bunch of sows with cubs, you know, that usually should tell you that, you know, you need to look somewhere else. Older boars usually spend a lot of their time at significantly lower elevation than all the younger bears. And I think that's really associated more with the water sources. If you get up high, you know, water's a lot less common, obviously. But, yeah, the mast is always going to dictate that from year to year. But if you have like a widespread mast crop, usually you can see the younger bears are going to be up high. Your older bears are going to be down lower elevation, and then your mother sows are just going to be tucked into some isolated corner trying to stay away from everybody else.
And when you say lower elevation for those big bears, they're like not necessarily down at the bottom of the mountain.
They could be.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's, okay. Interesting. Find me a neighborhood bear back of a subdivision. He's getting a trash can tore up.
I'm going to show you some pictures when we're done. Because you texted me, said, are you at the turkey show? I said, actually, I went for a drive for a few minutes. Well, I went about 10 minutes down the road, and I was looking at bear sign from the truck. I'll show it to you.
From the truck?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I am curious. What's the biggest bear, first off, that you've ever killed, but what's the biggest one you've seen that you couldn't get shot at?
The biggest one I've killed, probably about 250, 275.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest one I've ever seen, well, I've seen it multiple times. That was probably 2022. I started talking about him on Facebook and figured everybody knew who this bear was, apparently. His name was Scar. He had like this big old strip of fur on his backside that was missing. Usually that's from whenever they, you know, rub up against trees during the rut. But this was like a very obvious, like there wasn't any hair growing there from year to year because he got hit by a car, I think. But, I mean, this dude was huge. I was on a pretty popular trail system and I just walked up on him, you know, dead middle of the rut. And he had no care about me whatsoever, unless I got too close. So I ended up following him for like 2 hours. He dropped off of the high ridge and he just starts, you know, making his way across the landscape and he's leaving stomp trails and he just bulldozes through all these little trees and everything. Well, he was pretty much, you know, what you would call a resident bear that didn't really travel very far from year to year. And I found him again during archery season. I put a 40-yard shot on him, and I actually hit a piece of mountain laurel. And I watched my arrow go like 30 feet over him. It was terrible. It's one of them shots where you're like, I don't even need, like, look for a blood trail. I just know there's no possible way I hit that. But,
man, just a giant. It's like one of those bears. Looks like the head's just morphed onto like a body.
Yeah, people just, you know, they'll post a trail camera picture of him on Facebook and everybody just goes absolutely nuts. Like, oh, I've seen that thing. Well, don't tell nobody.
Did you learn anything from tracking that bear through the woods when you saw him and just followed him?
Yeah, and it's more or less the way dominant bears behave as far as... Well, I don't know if it'd even be a dominant, but just male bears in general. They like to walk through those saplings, and it basically the tree rubs up against their belly and their underside, and they're more or less leaving a scent trail everywhere they're going. It's territorial behavior, so if you translate that behavior into hunting season, well, they're still just as territorial over the food as they are the females. So... oftentimes, you know, a dominant bear, it's no secret where he's at because he's got it marked up for everybody to see. He's basically telling everybody to stay out. This is my spot, you know. So you can follow those little bent over saplings. And honestly, this year, I took a lot of pictures and I made a Facebook post about it. But there was this spot that I'd been hunting for 2 or 3 years now, and it's just a straight up mountain laurel jungle. And I started finding those bent over trees. This was such a hot spot, but I could never figure out why, because I couldn't find a water source. But just by following those bent over trees from that boar, he led me straight to the springhead that I've never been able to find on LIDAR or satellite or anything. So, I mean, just there's probably so many things that you can learn from just following them around, but, you know, put somebody on the spot and try to remember every single detail. I don't know if you could really remember every single thing.
Yeah. Have you ever had any close encounters with bear that was not optimal?
Yeah. I've only had two negative encounters. The first one was really just because I was a bonehead and I left my tent out in the woods. Instead of pre-setting my stand, I preset my campsite. So when I came back, my whole camp was destroyed. And it was like midnight when I found out. Like, I just got off work, hiked 3 miles in, just out in the middle of the woods with no camp. But as far as like the other negative encounter, it was with a sow with cubs. And it's such a rare occurrence, because it's funny. I've lost count of how many times I've bumped into sows with cubs. And one of the most funny encounters was, you know, I turned a corner and I bumped into her. Well, she took off and, you know, left the cubs with me. So you got to understand, they're really just goofy animals in general. But under this one circumstance where it was bad, I was actually, it was in the summertime, and I was going up to look at this cliff edge, because the way it was, it just had a lot of soft mass all around it. I just knew if I go up there in the summertime, I'm probably going to be able to take some pictures of bears. Well, I got up there, I started walking across the edge of the cliff, and it's one of them, like, if you step off of it, you're done, you know? So as I get to the other side of it, I start hearing just this most god-awful sound I've ever heard. Like, what is that? So I start going over towards it, and next thing you know, it sounds like there's a freaking bowling ball running down the mountain, and it's actually a 30-pound cub. It sees me, and then it climbs up a tree about 15 feet away from me. So I'm like, okay. So I'm trying to figure out what's going on. The screaming stops, and then here comes a sow with a second cub. I didn't know it at the time, but there was a boar actually killing her third cub. So the third one was dead, and she's coming running straight at me, trying to get away from the boar that's killing her cubs. I'm right in her path of travel, you know? So she's running just full fight or flight mode, and then she sees me, and then it's just like, oh, shit. Pull out my gun. I'm like, hey, you know, pop, 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 shoot 3 times in the ground, just anything to get her to stop. Cause I mean, she was charging, bud. And that finally got her to stop. And then, you know, she'd turn sideways. And what she did was she gave me an escort. You know, she started popping her teeth together. Just, you can hear them pop their jaws like that. And that's a warning. And, you know, she'd sit there and pounce her front feet. But every time I'd take 2 or 3 steps back, she'd take 2 or 3 steps forward. She started nudging me back across the cliff. And when I was far enough away from the cub that was in the tree, that's when she turned back around. And she, you know, they make like this inaudible grunt that we can't hear, but their cubs can. She pretty much signaled for the cub to come back down. And once it did, all 3 of them took off running. But, I mean, that one, that's probably the only time I was ever actually scared.
My favorite part of that story is how you're like, I heard this terrible sound, so I started walking towards it.
if that ain't something a white guy would do, I don't know what to describe. Straight out of the horror movie.
Straight out of a horror movie.
Let's go listen to that terrible sound, man, see how it goes. Did you ever find that cub that boar killed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure did.
Hmm. How they control their own population.
I found an adult bear that was killed by another bear, and it was actually like half eaten.
Whoa.
I think that one was a little bit cannibalistic, but yeah, I've seen a couple bears that were killed by other bears, but I've never actually seen one kill it and eat it, if that makes sense. So I tried to find that one and never could. But for the most part, as far as, you know, just being nervous around them in general, I mean, they're just overgrown coons, really.
Have you had them come mess with camp when you spot camped up there?
All the time.
At night or anything?
Yeah. I would usually camp up on ridge tops, but if you're there for a couple days, you got to have water to cook and drink and stuff, and it's just such a chore to always have to dip down and get water. So I started camping closer to the water sources. And, dude, when you do that, I mean, it's all the time they're coming into your camp. I mean, at one time it was two or three times in a night that I just had to get out and pop around off in the air just to get it to go away, you know. Hogs will do the same thing. I started just, you know, wearing earplugs to sleep at night just because every time a freaking stick breaks or something, like you wake back up, you're like, oh, what was that? But, dude, if you do this for a month straight, like, you got to sleep. You can't keep waking up all the time. So I started using earplugs. I woke up the next morning and a group of hogs had pretty much rooted a 15-foot radius around my campsite. I mean, they just, the whole ridge top was rooted except for like this circle around my tent. So I got up that morning and I was like, huh, maybe I shouldn't wear the earplugs, but yeah. That was a one-time deal.
Nah, that's a no for me, dog. That's a no for me.
Jacob, you want to go?
Nah, bro. Are you kidding me? Listen, just imagine you're sleeping in a hammock and that's something bumps you underneath the hammock.
Something comes up.
You're like three. You're like 3 feet on the ground. Something bumps into you. Hey, no, dude.
That's actually a semi-common occurrence on the southern end of the Appalachian Trail. Because, you know, they say there's like 30, 40,000 people at a time that go hike the Appalachian Trail in the springtime. Well, that's basically like the spring emergence when the bears come out and they're starving and hungry. And you got a lot of inexperienced hikers that, you know, they'll toss out their ramen noodles to the side or whatever. So the bears get really accustomed to people. So they've lost their fear. Like, they're not aggressive, but I've sit there and had them follow me down the Appalachian Trail when I was hiking, you know, over the summer. I mean, you could sit there and yell at it and sit there and swing sticks at it. I mean, a lot of times they've become such a nuisance that they need to be taken out. But
Bear Team 6.
Man, that's so wild. Overgrown coons. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's cool, man.
I don't know. Overgrown coon killed at least two people in Florida this year. Past year.
That's true.
I was like, bro, forget that.
I mean, big old coon mess you up, son. I've been bit by a coon.
We were talking about this on the podcast last year. We were talking about, this is such a side note, like, what animal in the woods, if it was the size of, like, we had a listener write in. Actually, it's my brother. So then this video question, what animal would you be most scared of in the woods if it was the size of like a golden retriever? It's like 80 pounds, 90 pounds, something like that. And I said a squirrel. But, dude, I mean, a big coon would be pretty gnarly. I mean, it's, I ain't much crazier than a black bear, but big squirrels, they got personality. they already act pretty tough.
Dude. I don't know, an 80-pound squirrel would be pretty vicious.
It'd be terrible. It's got some teeth, bro. Dude, imagine the size of the teeth on an 80-pound
squirrel. Still climb trees and be breaking limbs left and right, tripping timber. But they can move as fast as they can when they're little, and that big, whoo, son, that'd be a new horror movie.
Good grief, man.
We should film it as a horror movie. Squirrels attack.
Dylan, man, this has been awesome. This has been a great conversation.
We're having fun, dude.
Yeah, this is fun. And anytime we talk to someone who just goes out and does crazy stuff like what you do, it's always a good conversation, man. You realize how few people hunt like how you hunt. Very few people in the whole country, out of all the people that hunt, get to experience the things that you experience. So that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. I've tried to get other people to tag along and I figured out pretty quick. I'm pretty much doing this solo.
Hey, listen, if Andrew tough it out, send Andrew with you. He likes Thomas the Mountains.
I do like mountains, man.
We'll send Caden.
Yeah.
To film it. I'll stay in Alabama.
Dylan, if you had to give anyone who's going to start hunting the mountains just one piece of advice, what would it be?
Just learn how to read a topo map. That's really it. The topography in a low animal dense or a low animal density area is really going to be what drives your success.
Hmm. Very cool. And then what you post a lot on Facebook, you're in a couple groups that you're real active in, and your posts are really awesome. You'll post some map stuff and scouting, and it's actually really helpful, like seeing what you put out there. What groups are you active in case someone wants to go and kind of tag along?
Here lately, I've been posting in the Mobile Hunter, and I help run the Georgia Bear Hunters page. And 99% of what I share would be in the Bear Hunters page.
Cool.
Sweet. Awesome. Dylan, appreciate you doing the podcast, brother.
Yeah.
And for all the audio and video listeners out there, or audio listeners,
video
watchers, appreciate y'all watching the podcast and listening to the podcast, and we'll catch you back here on the next episode of the Southern Outdoorsman. And remember, guys, y'all stay Southern.
All right, y'all go ahead and mark your calendars. Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th is the Mobile Hunters Expo in Dalton, Georgia. Y'all have heard us talking about it for years, and it really is. It's the highlight of our summer. We absolutely love that show. We've met so many of you guys at that show over the years, and it is just it's like the perfect environment to go and meet like-minded hunters, hang out, have a good time, and get ready for deer season. So obviously, as the name implies, it is the place to go and try all of the mobile hunting gear coming out right now. We always recommend to people, if you're thinking about getting a new stand, a new sticks, a new saddle, go try it before you buy it. The Mobile Hunters Expo let you try almost all the brands in the mobile hunting space in one spot in one day. There's really nothing like it. So not only do you have all that gear available to you, they also have a great speaker lineup. This year they've got Bobby Worthington, Dylan Harper, Mariah Boggess, Derek Norwood, and BHA all giving presentations where you can go learn from those guys and ask them questions. So if you've heard us talk about the Mobile Hunters Expo for a couple years now and haven't made it out yet, don't let this be another year that you miss it. Y'all come on out. We'll have a great time. We're excited to meet you guys there. We can't wait for it. We'll see y'all there. Again, mark y'all's calendars. It's at the Dalton Convention Center in Dalton, Georgia, Friday, August 14th through Sunday, August 16th. See y'all there. All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. introducing the Vortex Crossfire spotting scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. And it's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire spotting scopes, or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code SOUTHERN10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just southern deer hunters or southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.